Well, thank you for joining me in this special edition of the Brian Sussman Show podcast. Special because we've got a wonderful guest. Dr. Calvin Beisner will be joining us in just a moment. He's the founder and president of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. It's a Christian organization who looks at the world through a lens that sees through the propaganda, sees through the misinformation, and brings solutions for a better planet and a better lifestyle for all. He's written a tremendous book. It's called Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. And it's interesting. You can see the man holding that pane of glass. It's essentially the invisible man, because so much of what we know about the climate agenda, for example, is phony baloney. So in this book, he's assembled a wonderful cast of true professionals in their fields. These are PhDs in the world of meteorology, atmospheric science, astrophysics, geology, economy, energy. These are all top professionals who have written some wonderful essays to show you that the climate agenda is a hoax, and there are real solutions that we should consider, because the solutions that are being given to us by the left are hardly solutions at all. Now, my first question for Dr. Beisner was this. There are a lot of people today who believe that Christianity and science are completely incompatible. They're two distinctly different spheres that can never possibly come together.
I get that question very, very frequently. And I always start with one single verse in the Bible. In 1 Thessalonians 5:21, the Apostle Paul wrote, "Test all things, hold fast what is good." Now, that's the scientific method. That is probably the briefest summary I've ever seen of scientific method. And it's exactly what Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman summarized in a very famous video clip that anybody can find real quickly just by searching online for "Key to Science" and Richard Feynman. Feynman says, look, when scientists want to try to figure out a law of nature, to understand how something in nature works, first they guess. And his audience kind of chuckled at that, because they want something sounding more scientific, like hypothesis or theory, right, or something. No. First they guess, then they make predictions of what they ought to find out in the natural world, the real world, if their guess is true. Then they go out into the world and they look and they observe. And if what they see in the physical world contradicts their predictions, then their guess, their hypothesis, their theory, whatever it is wrong. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter how beautiful the guess is, or how smart they are, or I'll add this, or how many scientists agree with them, right? If the observations contradict the predictions, the theory is wrong. And that, he says, is the key to science. Well, that's also what Paul meant when he said, test all things, hold fast what is good.
But that brings us neatly to the whole climate change debate, doesn't it?
Because it
does. When I look at the hypothesis of anthropogenic climate change, or the theory, I just see it falling short. So yeah. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, we have a number of chapters in the book. For instance, Dr. Roy Spencer's chapter on climate models, and Pat Michaels did that chapter with some help from John Christie,
right,
comparing climate models with actual real-world measurements. All of the fears of dangerous to catastrophic to existential threat human-induced climate change, all of the fears, 100%, are based on computer climate model output. None of them on actual real-world observations. Hmm. The climate models, for example, tell us that as the world warms, we should be getting more frequent and more extreme or severe weather problems, you know, hurricanes, droughts, floods, tornadoes, heat waves, cold snaps. All of these things should be coming, should be becoming more frequent and more severe. But actual real world observation says, no, there's no upward trend in any of those things. And if anything, there's a little bit of a downward trend in hurricanes. And so it's no surprise, as Dr. Neil Frank, the longest serving director of the National Hurricane Center, affirmed to me after I had said that in a public place and people had ridiculed me, well, you're not a climatologist, you're not a meteorologist, what do you know? And
but you're
Neil,
right.
Neil called me. Neil called me up on my phone in my seminary office. Goodness gracious, 18 years ago now, and he said, "You don't know me, but I'm Neil Frank. I'm the longest-serving director of the National Hurricane Center." And I thought, "Oh no, I'm going to get it now." And he said, "I just called to tell you, stick to your guns. You're right."
Good. Wow. What a great phone call. I hadn't heard that before. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, okay, yeah. but let's think about the name of your organization. It's the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation.
Yes.
So again, you know, a lot of people on the left, a lot of those who are anti-Christianity have a hard problem with this, a hard time with this. But when you talk about creation, you're willing to look at the geological record. I mean,
sure.
You may be, there are some Christians, just like some Orthodox Jews, who believe the world is 5,874 years old, period. But we're able to just step back. Let's look at the geological record as we have it. Clearly, it's been warmer in past periods of time, correct?
And that is so, regardless whether you take the sort of conventional, say the Earth is 4 billion years old or 5 billion years old, whatever, the conventional thinking in geology, or a young Earth approach to geology. Either way,
yes,
there are clearly revealed through geology periods of the Earth that are warmer and periods that are cooler. Global average temperature has risen and fallen cyclically throughout the history of the planet, regardless how long that is.
Yeah.
And so the notion that the simple fact that we've seen global warming over the last 170 years or so, which I have no problem with affirming, I think that's clearly shown, the fact that the warming has happened doesn't tell us why. And the assumption that it is all human activity that has caused it is simply not necessary and, in fact, not defensible, because we know that similar warmings have happened in the past without any SUVs and without, you know, concrete making and all of that stuff that people blame for human-induced global warming.
When you look at the current debate, the side that is really and truly trying to impress upon the people that fossil fuels have changed the climate, we're on a precipice. If we don't go to net zero soon, we're doomed. What in your opinion, I've obviously got a lot of strong opinions on this, but what in your opinion is driving that thought?
Well, and you've written a lot of good stuff in this field as well, so I've benefited from much of it. You know, what's driving it? That really varies from person to person. I hate to just lump everybody together. Goodness, there, of course, are the scientists who really are convinced. Frankly, I don't think that's an awful lot who are convinced that global warming, A, is real, and B, is overwhelmingly human-induced, and C, is already causing grave harms, and D, is catastrophe lurking around the corner, and therefore, E, we need to spend trillions of dollars completely revamping the global energy infrastructure to get away from fossil fuels and go to wind and solar. Mm-hmm. I think the number of actual climate scientists who would embrace all of that is actually probably vanishingly small.
Yes.
Where the real agreement is, yeah, global average temperature has probably risen by about 1 degree Celsius since about 1850. Yeah, human emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases have almost certainly contributed to that. But beyond that, what percentage of the warming can be attributed to this? I don't think there's great agreement on that. I think also, frankly, a lot of the environmentalist movement for generations has been aiming to persuade everybody that we need to reduce total human population. They think that we are overpopulated, which is why the old Optimal Population Trust, which now has a different name, once had on its website, doesn't anymore, that optimal human population would be around 300 million people. Mm-hmm. Ted Turner held the same opinion. I think Bill Gates thinks something similar to that.
Yeah.
Generally, 300 to 500 million would be optimal human population. And they see persuading people that our use of fossil fuels, which gives us the prosperity necessary to support such a large population, is causing potentially devastating global warming. They see that as the best rationale for promoting human population control, which can only be done through very, very tight government controls over our private lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that in turn requires not just that this or that country around the world cooperates, but that they all cooperate, which in turn means you have to undermine national sovereignty. You have to get more and more government shifted to a global level,
mm-hmm.
Which is why the French prime minister back in 1999 said that the Kyoto Protocol to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change was our first step toward global governance. Mm. And it's why Cristiana Figueres, the former secretary of the Framework Convention on Climate Change, said that the Paris Climate Summit was our first opportunity to completely revamp the world's economic system to get away from what we've been used to for the last 150 years and go to a different one. Well, what she had in mind was socialism instead of capitalism. So those kinds of things motivate an awful lot of people in this.
You know, I've had debates over the years with some of these population anti-population zealots.
Yes.
And I've asked them, okay, if we're supposed to get down below a billion people, how are we going to do that? How would you suggest we get to that population level? Is it going to be widespread disease? Is it famine? I mean, what do you have in mind to get there? They'll never answer that question. But it's
no,
frightening.
They won't,
it's chilling when you think about it, Cal.
But the problem is the history of the anti-population growth movement and the history of eugenics speak something very, very different. You know, Darwin's theory of evolution by competition for limited resources, which, by the way, was based on Thomas Robert Malthus's essay on the principle of population back in 1798. Darwin's theory fed the notion of eugenics through his, I believe it was his nephew, Francis Galton, who wrote a book on human potential about two decades after Origin of Species came out. That in turn fed Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood here in America, who, by the way, was greatly admired by and returned the admiration of Adolf Hitler of the Nazis in Germany. This movement has consistently reached toward coercive means of shrinking population. That has been the case, for instance, in the imposition of forced sterilization on literally millions of men and women, particularly in countries like India and China. And what's really irksome in all of this is that so many progressives embrace this kind of thing, and they seem to be utterly unaware that it's all as racist as can be. So we have to recognize, you know, to put the theologian's hat back on here for a moment, Satan hates God. He cannot attack God directly, obviously, and he knows that. So what does he do? He attacks God's image, men and women created in God's image.
Hmm.
And he does that partly through the whole population control movement, through organizations like the Rockefeller Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Tides Foundation, and more that promote this kind of thinking.
And I'm just curious, how much of this evil, how much of these intentions are directed, in your opinion, at the United States of America first?
Well, as probably the most capitalist country over the last 200 years or so, socialists tend to think of the United States as the great target. They recognize that we have been crucial to the maintenance of liberty and freedom and democracy around the world for the last 100 years anyway. And so we're a main target. So for instance, China is playing the West like a fiddle in terms of the whole climate change agenda. They have gained control of the vast majority of the production of solar panels, wind turbines, batteries for EVs, things of that sort, the mining of lithium, the mining of cobalt, the fabrication of these things, and much of it, by the way, by Uyghur slave labor, right? China has gained control of like 90%, ballpark figure, of all of these different things. And it is using these to impoverish the West so that we are less able to resist China's attempt to fulfill Chairman Mao's dream of the 100-year marathon back in 1949, when Mao's revolution took over China. He said, in 100 years, we are going to surpass the United States as the world's superpower. That's their aim, and they are using the climate agenda to achieve exactly that. We offer, through our online bookstore, by the way, two excellent monographs about how China is doing this. So people can go to cornwallalliance.org and click on the shop button and find those two monographs, and they'll understand exactly what China is doing.
Yeah, China, they're very, people have to understand this. Those deeply held beliefs, they're long suffering. They're willing to be very patient to see their ends fulfilled. And a lot of times you see this with leftist organizations at large. They're very, very patient. You know, in a capitalistic world, we're thinking
Oh, yes.
quarterly.
Yeah,
I got the next
right.
3 months to get this done. They're thinking long term. And we need to be aware of that. And so I'm just kind of curious, Cal, in light of it, because you talk a lot about this in your book, you know, it's half the book's about energy and our
Yeah.
grid. So I'm sure China is very eager for us to go to or attempt to go to a net zero grid for a myriad of reasons. One, it's good for
Absolutely.
their economy, and two, it's going to crush us.
Yeah, it's good for their economy. It's very bad for our economy. That would be it. And to give you a notion of how bad it is, a couple of months ago, Bjørn Lomborg of the Copenhagen Consensus, brilliant economist and statistician and environmental economist particularly, Bjørn put an article in Wall Street Journal in which he reported what he figured out as the cost of achieving net zero by 2050. Net zero, of course, for those in the audience who don't know what that means, is our emissions of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere are matched or exceeded by how much we pull out of the atmosphere, right? And basically, since there's no really good way to pull much out, what that means is we have to cut our emissions enormously, right? So Lomborg figured out that in order to achieve net zero by 2050, the cost to the global economy would be an average of about, I believe the figure was $28 trillion per year, rising from below that now to $68 trillion in the year 2100.
Yes.
Now, he also pointed out that the actual effect on global average temperature would be a fraction of a degree, a small fraction of a degree. Now, Ed, I can't figure anybody who thinks that's a good cost-benefit analysis. That's just insanity. What we're going to see, he also pointed out, by the way, and we've talked about this in our book, suddenly shifting away from all fossil fuels would essentially, within a matter of months, starve half the human population
Wow.
because 50% of the people in the world depend almost 100% for their food on farming that is done using fertilizers produced using natural gas. If we stop using fossil fuels, those fertilizers will disappear. The farming will just collapse, and those people will starve. Further, if we stop using fossil fuels completely, over a period of a few more years, another 2 billion, Lomborg says, will die because the fossil fuels are essential to the making of steel and concrete and all of the electronic equipment and everything that human life depends on nowadays. So, I mean, there we go. We're back to population control and to population reduction.
Wow.
Net zero is essentially a prescription for how to get billions of people out of the world.
Wow. It reminds me in so many ways, and you know, this is the wheelhouse that I enjoy exploring. People forget that Vladimir Lenin was an ardent environmentalist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's writing.
So was Hitler.
And Hitler was as well.
Yep.
But Lenin was spending, while his people were starving to death and unable to get wood from the forest just to heat their homes during the winter,
mm-hmm.
people are starving and freezing to death, and he's writing lengthy papers about saving the environment. So yep. In many ways, a lot of things haven't changed.
No, they really haven't. And I think that's testimony to how all of this is much more deeply rooted in history than a lot of people recognize. Back at the start of the 20th century, the conservationist movement in America was largely led by people who were strong industrialists. They believed heavily in free markets and so on. And they wanted to conserve the natural world, by which they meant we want to make sure that we use it in wise ways so that we hand it down to the coming generations in equally good shape as we find it, mm-hmm. but we do want to develop the resources in it to serve the needs of humanity. So it's not surprising that conservation and conservative have the same etymology. That began to turn to change into the preservationist movement in the 1950s and 1960s, which reflected the notion of some ecologists that nature is best untouched by human hands, that we should minimize the human footprint on the world, which is completely contrary to the teaching of Genesis 1:28 that we are supposed to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish in the sea and the birds of the air and everything that moves on the face of the earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the preservationist movement was very, very different. That movement is what gave rise to the environmentalist movement. The first use of the word environmentalism, I think, was in the early 1970s. And that movement really sought to flip the hierarchy in the world's system, right? In the Judeo-Christian worldview, you have God at the top, you have humanity under God, made in his image and given dominion over the rest, and then you have the rest, mm-hmm. right? In the environmentalist worldview, you have the natural world at the top, you have humans under that, and then you have God, well, if at all,
right.
under humans. He really doesn't have any authority anymore. That's what has happened. We've had a complete flipping mm-hmm. of the hierarchy of the worldview. The result is that we're being told to minimize our footprint, carbon footprint, for instance, whereas the scripture tells us that we are supposed to subdue and rule all of creation, not abusively, not, you know, raping the earth or something mm-hmm. like that, but reflecting how God did it. He started with nothing, he made everything. He started with darkness, he made light. He started with chaos, he made order. He started with non-life, he made life, and great variety of life. So what should we be doing? We should be reflecting that, bringing more and more order out of less and less order, more and more light, knowledge, understanding out of ignorance, more and more life out of non-life, and great variety and abundance of life. And we can do that, by the way. And the notion that economic development and economic growth are inimical to a good environment is just, frankly, backward.
Yeah.
A clean, healthful, beautiful environment is a costly good. And like any other costly good, wealthier people can afford more of it than poorer people can. So economic growth, economic development is actually the friend of environmental stewardship, not its enemy. And the free market is a far better steward of the environment than socialism, because people have an incentive to take good care of what they own. Nobody has an incentive to take care of what nobody owns, or equivalently, the state owns. Yes.
We don't you think, really and truly, I know this would irritate so many on the left, but when you step back and look at the big picture, the United States of America, wealthiest nation in history, the birthplace of industrials, well, in so many ways, the birthplace of modern industrialization.
Yes.
We have done a remarkable job in this country of being stewards of the environment. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And it is primarily by private ownership of land, right?
Yes.
I mean, for instance, the vast wildfires that have hit the West in recent years have happened almost entirely on federal and somewhat on state-owned land, hardly at all on privately owned land. Why is that? Well, it's for the same reason that, Brian, I guarantee you don't have any graffiti on your bathroom walls at home, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you own your home, mm-hmm. and you have an incentive to keep it looking nice, right? You want to resell it sometime for a profit. But we find graffiti on public bathroom walls. Well, there's no incentive for the government to take good care of its forests. And back in the 1970s, a particular view of forest management took over that said, look, leave it to nature, hands off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what that did was it started to send us back to what California and other Western states had been experiencing through all of history.
Yes.
That is massive wildfires that dwarf even the biggest ones that we've had in the last 20 years or so, mm-hmm. By 20 or 30 or 40 times. It's sending us back. Why? Because we don't selectively cut. We don't remove undergrowth. We don't remove fallen branches and whatnot. So the fuel builds up. And when a fire gets going, whether by lightning or by arson or anything else, man, the fuel is there and it burns hotter and faster than anything that we see on privately owned land that is properly managed.
I mean, right. The private landowners care for their land. They want to steward it accordingly. But I love the United States of America in that we have cleaned up our skies.
Yeah.
We have cleaned up our rivers. We're doing a wonderful job. We should be the model for the rest of the world. But instead, from the environmentalist point of view, we seem to be the enemy.
Just within the 1970s to early 1980s, the emission of the, I believe it's six different criteria air pollutants in the United States fell at average by about 90%, the least fall was about 60%. Most of them fell by close to 98%. And we've brought them down more since then. Frankly, most of the wild waters in America today are less polluted now than they were in the early 19th century. The air is less polluted now than it was even in the 1980s and 1990s. We have clean air, we have clean water, and this is partly it's because of regulation, but it's much more because private owners want clean, mm-hmm. clean stuff. And frankly, when companies harm their neighbors through pollution, people can go to court and sue them, and the court can tell them, "Not, you have to stop that."
And isn't it interesting?
We've done well with that.
We've brought down all these real pollutants to clean up our mm-hmm. skies. So it's as if they've had to invent a new pollutant, CO2.
Yes.
Suddenly CO2 is deemed a pollutant. It's necessary for life.
Absolutely,
You have an entire generation now that's been raised believing it's evil.
Yeah, you know, back in middle school, again, we referred to the definition of energy. Well, also in middle school, we all learned about photosynthesis, right? Plants take in carbon dioxide and they put out oxygen, right? Plants mm-hmm. and animals have this wonderful symbiotic relationship. Well, the more CO2 there is in the air in which a plant is growing, the more that plant is going to grow. on average, for every doubling of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, you get a 35% increase in plant growth efficiency. They grow better in warmer and cooler temperatures. They grow better in wetter and drier soils. They make better use of soil nutrients. They resist diseases and pests better. And they expand their fruit production. They improve their fruit to fiber ratio. All of this is good news, partly because it means there's more plant right there where it's always been for whatever animals eat that plant, but also because it means that these plants can grow in places they didn't grow before.
Right.
So they expand their range. That means all the different fauna that depend on these plants for life can expand their ranges too. And here's a real irony. Some people are saying that climate change is bringing in the sixth great extinction, for which, by the way, there is no empirical evidence whatsoever. It's all about computer modeling again, and the models fail just as much as do the climate models, which, by the way, simulate 2 to 4 times as much warming as actually observed over the relevant period. But these models of biogeography that predict this sixth great extinction completely ignore the fact that with more CO2 in the atmosphere, plants expand their range, they grow more, and as a result, all the animals that depend on them have a more secure life. Mm-hmm. If you're worried about species extinction, you should be glad that we're using fossil fuels to put more CO2 into the atmosphere and make plants grow more. We've seen an increase in leaf area index measured by satellite imagery from space around the world, equivalent to adding all the vegetation in the entire continental United States since 1990.
Wow.
And that's all because of CO2.
Do you think we're winning this battle? Are we gaining more converts to the truth?
In academic circles, in the mainstream media, among political leaders, I don't see an awful lot of shift happening. In the populace as a whole, I do. I think that more and more people are coming to understand the basics here. Mm-hmm. I certainly hope that our book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, is going to help with that. The Cornwall Alliance, with all of the things that we publish for the last 19 years, has been helping with that. I think we're doing good work here. One thing I can point to as evidence of that, in 2015, when Cornwall Alliance was only 9 years old. George Soros's New America Foundation commissioned a study by two major Ivy League sociologists trying to answer the question, why, after 2 decades of various left-wing foundations, including his own, spending hundreds of millions of dollars trying to get evangelical Christians onto the global warming bandwagon, why did evangelical Christians remain the most skeptical demographic in America of catastrophic global warming? They took a year for the study. When they released it, you could summarize the 80-some page paper as the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. And since then, there have been, I know of at least 4 different books in the years from 2015 to today, including one that just came out last year, that try to answer the same question and basically come down to the same answer. So I'm pretty excited about that.
This is what I love about your organization. You're not beholden to anyone, the Cornwall
right.
Alliance. You're here to serve people with the truth. And I would also like you to just for a moment talk about your book, because there is an excellent opportunity that you've made available. I know you had this going through the month of April, but prior to our taping of this interview, you said you were going to continue it during the month of May. So could you share that with the audience?
Yeah.
This is really exciting.
Well, thanks. Yeah. As our way of saying thank you, when people make a 100% tax deductible donation to the Cornwall Alliance, they can do that at cornwallalliance.org/donate. That's cornwallalliance.org/donate. when people make a donation of literally any size and ask for climate and energy, we'll be glad to send them a free copy, and their entire donation will be tax deductible. Now, of course, you know, we hope that they'll donate enough to cover our costs for the book. You know, the book retails, I think, at $39 or something like that. We hope that they'll donate at least enough for that. But frankly, our desire is just to get the word out. The people who already donate to us want us to get the word out. So those who want a copy, all they need to do is make a donation of any size at cornwallalliance.org. And as they do it, just ask for climate and energy. I'll be glad
Fantastic.
To send a
copy. I also highly encourage people to go to your website, Cornwall Alliance. Your blog is always very informative. And it's just you got some great articles written by some super people. It's very informative. Again, I can't recommend it highly enough. Calvin, thank you for spending some time with me on this podcast, and best of luck on the book. And I hope we can really encourage some people to go out there and get a copy and share it with their friends.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. It's a privilege to be with you. I've admired your work for what, going on 20 years now or something like that. And just thank you so much. I appreciate your support for the Cornwall Alliance as well.
Don't forget to pick up your copy of Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism by Calvin Beisner and David LeGates. And by the way, Dr. David LeGates will be our guest in my next podcast episode. And while you're picking up a copy of their book, don't forget Climate Cult, Exposing and Defeating Their War on Life, Liberty, and Property. I do appreciate it. Thank you for watching. Thanks for your support. God bless you, my friends.